The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Bonjour, hi Canada. Tuesday, May 25th, year of our Lord, 2021. I'm Hugh Hewitt, inside the Beltway. Here is the rundown. Somehow I missed that Bob Dylan turned 80 yesterday. I got back from dinner with my friend Glenn last night and opened up the show prep file and found about 50 stories on Bob Dylan. We'll just salute him with some music today. 80 years old. Been doing this for 60 years. I think my radio career of 31 years and television career been about 15 years of one and 20 of the other with some overlap is pretty good, but it's half of what Dylan has done in terms of just doing what he does every day. He's out there still singing. So happy birthday, Bob Dylan, belatedly. President Biden is going to meet with George Floyd's family today, a year after he was murdered at the hands of a Minnesota police officer. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said the president is eager to listen to their perspectives and hear what they have to say. The Senate reconvened and immediately ran into headaches yesterday on the bill that I talked about with Jake Sherman yesterday, which is the $250 billion bill that is supposed to put us onto a competitive footing with China. The United States Innovation and Competition Act ran into a blizzard of amendments. Yeah, slow going there. Secretary Tony Blinken is in the State of Israel. This is the seventh United States Secretary of State that Bibi Netanyahu has met as prime minister. Five of them Democrats, two of them Republicans. There's a good thing to be said for stability in a democratic state, and that is nothing the Americans can say can really surprise Netanyahu. He's heard it all before, especially with this is the fifth Democrat. The Wuhan lab leak, a disused Chinese mine takes center. This is really amazing to me. This is a story by Jeremy Page, Betsy McKay, and Drew Hinshaw. Extremely detailed story on the Wuhan lab theory of the case. And Glenn Kessler in the Washington Post has a long explainer on why this story didn't come to light last year. Well, look, on February 18th of last year, I mean, it's 15 months ago, Tom Cotton was on this show, and we were talking about the abuse that was being heaped on him because he had been discussing the Wuhan lab theory. And it's not enough to detail why the media, that the media missed it. You have to explain not only that they missed it and who missed it, but those who condemned those who had it right in detail so we can see who not to trust in their condemnation. I doubt that Glenn will be fact-checking his fact-check. Belarus is rightly isolated as other countries move to ban flights and an extraordinary number of sanctions. They're not enough. They should do more. And there's a great banking power. The United States has the great banking power. They can shut down most financial transactions in the world to a country. We have never used that. We ought to be using it. This is piracy, simple piracy. And the world has taken note of it. Now, Putin may come to the rescue of his thug buddy in Belarus, who sees Protasevich off of the Ryan airplane. But whether or not they do, they ought to just be the completely outlawed state. It's a rogue state. Iran should be in for the same thing, by the way. It exports terror. And this whole shaking of fists at Belarus is justified, but there is absolutely no distinction between Belarus and Iran. And I wish people would make that point, that there is no distinction between Belarus and Iran. They both engage in state-supported terrorism. But if it's easy to see, the world unites. And if it's a little bit more difficult to see or perhaps inconvenient because of the oil, they don't. So they barred European Union airlines from the country's airspace. And that's just a start. They ought to go far more. Ron DeSantis is going to sign into law, or already did. It was signed yesterday. A law that says that online companies like Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter that moderate speech online will be fined if they permanently bar political candidates in the state. Now, I think this bill has some constitutional issues. If I see Governor DeSantis at the Republican Governors Association, we'll talk about that. He's a very good lawyer. And it looks like content discrimination, that they're singling out political speech for particular practices. And I don't know that they can do that. But what they could do is turn these companies into a public utility. I'm increasingly of the mind they should. This should not be a news story, but it is. New York City schools will be fully in person in the fall. No remote learning. Well, there is no reason to have remote learning anywhere right now. So is it news? What's news is that the teachers union have finally given up hope of keeping the schools closed wherever they have succeeded in keeping the schools closed. Now, this is not teachers' fault. It's the teachers' unions and the Democratic Party, which they support. From Ynet News in Israel, two Israelis, including a soldier moderately hurt in a stabbing attack in Jerusalem. An additional story from the Jerusalem Post. No ceasefire in Jerusalem as violence continues. The leaders of Palestinian Authority and Hamas stated in the past few days that the ceasefire does not mean that the battle for Jerusalem has ended. There's a very disturbing story in the Times of Israel. Support for Israel among U.S. evangelical Christians drops sharply. It's among younger evangelicals. And I think that reflects no change in belief system. They still go to youth groups. They still have a tentative grip on the gospel and what it means. But they have zero political education in high school. My support for Israel has never been theological. That's nonsense. It's been because it's our only Democratic ally in the Middle East, and it's a mini superpower on which much of our interest in that region depends. And it ought to be simply a democratic state among non-democratic states that we support and stand by. Brett Stephen has an amazing column today. Anti-Zionism isn't anti-Semitism. Someone didn't get the memo. In recent years, he writes, it's become an article of faith on the progressive left that anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism, and that it's slander to assume someone who hates Israel also hates Jews. Not everyone got the memo. Not the people who waving Palestinian flags and chanting death to Jews, according to a witness, assaulted Jewish diners at a Los Angeles sushi restaurant. Not the people who threw fireworks into New York Diamonds District. Not the people who brutally beat up a man wearing a yarmulke in Times Square. Not the people who drove through London slurring Jews and yelling, rape their daughters. Not the people who gathered outside a synagogue in Germany shouting slurs. Not the people who at a protest in Brussels chanted, Jews, remember Kabar. The army of Mohammed is returning. Also not getting the memo are the people who have tweeted the hashtag Hitler was right, including someone who now works for the BBC, along with the hashtag COVID-1948, a suggestion that Israel is a virus that needs to be cured by Hamas rockets as the vaccine. Apparently, these hashtags count as legitimate political speech at Twitter. The company's objections to bigotry are otherwise so strong that it once banned a Canadian feminist for the sin of tweeting remarks about transgender women like men aren't women. A big profile puff piece by Ashley Parker on Joe Biden. And I like puff pieces on the president. Weightlifting, Gatorade, birthday calls, inside Biden's day, in which it is revealed he eats like a five-year-old. Well, I've got no problem with that. He likes sandwiches and chips. But it's a pretty boring presidency. It's grandpa's presidency. And we all know that. The post-embarrassment media campaign of Andrew Yang. This is a very interesting story in the New York Times that Andrew Yang has made so many blunders, done so many dumb things that he's going to win anyway. And the question is whether or not, like, he tweeted his love of New York bodegas with a video on what looked like a capacious supermarket. He reminisced about waiting in, not online, at a New York restaurant, Shake Shack. More seriously, he offended a gay Democratic club while seeking endorsement and walked back an initial response to Israeli-Palestinian conflict that didn't acknowledge violence against the Palestinians. So the left-wing New York Times doesn't know what to do with him. My favorite story of the entire day, though, comes from National Review, and it's 2 days old. I missed it yesterday. Austin, Texas's revolt against a homelessness surge. You know, there aren't any liberals, and there aren't any leftists when it comes to homeless people. They don't want them. They're NIMBYs. They're just NIMBYs, and they don't have any solutions. And when a judge like Judge David Carter comes up with a solution in Los Angeles, they rally together to try and appeal and throw him out of the case because they've got the money. They don't care about those people. They don't care about the problem or the property owners. They care about the money. Finally, in Turkey, extraordinary story this morning. A mobster's online confessions are shaking Erdogan's government. Turkey is riveted. I didn't know anything about this until last night. And I was staying up late after dinner with Glenn because the Indians were locked in a 6-5 win. They want the win, but Clay's, our fireballing 100-mile-an-hour pitcher, was taking his time getting the three bases were loaded with two out in the ninth, bottom of the ninth, when we finally won. But I was reading this in between pitches, and evidently organized crime is deep into the Erdogan government. And, you know, it doesn't surprise me that there's a history in Turkey of organized crime being involved with the government. And but Erdogan has always said he got rid of that. Well, this fellow, Peker, I don't know how you say it. He's been doing videos from a hotel room somewhere, and he's making the most extraordinary statements. And it's just riveting Turkey and convulsing Erdogan, who needs to be tossed out, as everybody knows. We'll be right back, America. Lots to do on today's Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt on the day after the 80th birthday of Bob Dylan. I don't know if David M. Drucker, the Washington Examiner, is a Dylan fan. Are you, David?
I mean, who's not a Dylan fan, right?
I agree.
I appreciate him as an American musical poet. What is that?
Have you seen him in concert? I've been three times. Very interspersed.
I have not seen him in concert. Now, granted, I'm not a huge concert goer for whatever reason. I've always been much more about going to live sporting events, but it's something that I would do if I could.
Best concert ever went. Rolling Thunder Review, Boston, Dylan, Joni Baez, Joni Mitchell, and Roger McGuinn. Quite the show. Okay, let's talk about what do Tom Cotton, Nikki Haley, Kristi Noem, Mike Pompeo, Rick Scott, and Tim Scott have in common, David Drucker, according to the article you published this morning in the D.C. Examiner?
They're all running for president in 2024, and they've all been to Iowa or are going to Iowa very shortly, which tells you that the field is not frozen and nobody's waiting around for Trump, which nobody means as an insult to Trump, but they all plan to run, and nobody's going to just sit around and not prepare, given what it takes to run a successful campaign in this day and age if you're not Trump. And I think a lot of that is being missed because there's been so much focus on, you know, will he or won't he? And of course, everybody's scared out of their mind of him. And while a lot of them walk on eggshells around him, they're not as scared as people think. And they're certainly not so scared that they're not doing anything.
Now, I've never done, except in 2016, the Iowa thing. CNN took me to Des Moines in 2016 for the debates that were there. And it was fascinating. It's interesting. It was cold. And I have been told that Pompeo had blowout crowd, that they can't get enough, that the Iowa Republicans are eager for this fight. And have you heard the same thing? I mean, they're all doing very well.
I have heard the same thing. You know, Pompeo, by the way, you know, people have a lot of opinions of him, especially as Democratic critics, but he's an underappreciated retail talent as a politician. If all you've seen of him is his gruff news conferences, you're missing something that he happens to be good at, which is connecting with individual voters. And he sort of lets pieces of himself out in dribs and drabs to connect with people. Nikki Haley's doing a big Republican Party of Iowa fundraising dinner at the end of June, which I'm planning to go to see how she looks these days in terms of her connection to the Republican base, given some of her friction with Trump. There is a huge hunger on the ground for politics. Now, that may not be new in Iowa, but I think what I'm getting at here from talking to people is that there's just a lot of engagement on the part of Republican voters, grassroots Republicans. They always like the attention in Iowa. The caucuses on the Republican side, at least, I do expect to go first again in 24. But they're engaged, so the party is not dispirited, and they're looking ahead early to the next campaign. And because there are a handful of competitive races there, or at least races in contention, it gives a lot of 2024 Republicans an excuse to go and help out. So you don't have to be totally transparent about it, even though you are. But there's a lot to do there between the governor's race, some House races, and a potential Senate race, depending on what Chuck Grassley decides to do.
Now, I am firmly in Switzerland. I've gone back to Switzerland because a lot of these people are my friends. and a lot of them are, in fact, friends with each other, like Cotton and Pompeo are buddies. And it's going to be a very interesting series of debates, and I want to moderate them. But I think that the interesting thing that is going to go on here is there will be two kinds of candidates. Those who got along with and supported Trump and those who didn't or breached the faith in some way that the Trump base considers unforgivable. And I think Chris Christie, Tom Cotton, and Mike Pompeo are in the former. And I think the vice president and Nikki Haley are in the latter, and I don't think Tim Scott and Kristi Noem are anywhere on that spectrum. What do you think? And by the way, has Chris Christie been there yet? Because he's definitely running, too. He's the only guy who's told me he's running. He said he hadn't ruled it out.
By the way, he's the only one that will say he doesn't care whether Trump runs or not. Now, that may not be true, but he just said that in an interview on Ruthless the other day. Look, I put Kristi Noem in the pro-Trump category in terms of never has gotten on the wrong side of Trump. I think you're right about the former vice president and Haley in terms of they're in the sort of, you know, Trump with friction sort of category. I think the vice president's gotten a particularly raw deal out of this, by the way. I mean, Haley, you know, she can't seem to decide whether she's going to be a Trump critic or a Trump acolyte, and voters don't like you going back and forth. I mean, Mike Pence has been nothing but loyal. The only thing he did was stick up for the Constitution, which, you know, he knew the political risk that was entailed in that, and he's getting an extremely raw deal from the president and from Republican voters on that front. But I think you're right in how this thing is going to shake out. I do expect, though, that all but one of a huge crowd of candidates will run in some fashion or another as a Trump heir, and it'll be the first contest we've had since 1980 without Reagan or a Reagan acolyte presenting themselves to voters.
Well, I think Cotton and Pompeo are both Reagan acolytes and Ted Cruz. We will see. We will see. David Drucker, thank you. Stay tuned, America. Hour two ahead. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. It's Tuesday, so I'm joined by Byron York of the Washington Examiner. You see him on Fox News as well. Good morning, Byron. How are you?
Good morning. You're doing well. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. I want to talk to you about Wuhan today with this setup that is slightly self-serving. If there was a Pulitzer for early, consistent, and eventually accurate coverage of the Wuhan virus, it would be me. I would win. And I think you'd get the runner-up award because I think I have 15 hours a week and you don't have that much time. But we were both on this thing. Now Tom Cotton is getting some belated recognition for having been first to the bell among the electeds. But they are not covering the media's disdain and the condemnation that Cotton got for raising the issue of Wuhan. And Glenn Kessler is a colleague of mine at the Post, and I like Glenn, but he wrote this long sort of chronology of the Wuhan story and said, yeah, Cotton said something in January and February, but he didn't cover the fact that it unleashed an avalanche of condemnation, abuse, and mockery on him. Is that part of the story, Byron, how radioactive the media, left-wing mainstream media, made the Wuhan story?
It is absolutely part of the story. First of all, I mean, there are two parts of the story. The first and the biggest is the origin of this virus. We need to know it. And the sooner we know it and the more we know about it, the better off we will be. So that's the biggest part, the big substance part. But what happened when Tom Cotton went on television and suggested that the virus might have come from the laboratory. He didn't suggest that it was a bioweapon or intentional, but he said there was something going, although he didn't that it was some sort of mishap in the laboratory. He was absolutely condemned. People who said this sort of thing were their opinions were suppressed. They were criticized, they were ridiculed, they were read out of the conversation. I was on Fox last night, Brett Baer's program, and Bill Bennett said, you know, the elephant in the room here is Trump, that if anyone said anything that media figures thought was consistent or supportive of the Trump position, then everyone took the opposite position. And Trump was blaming China. He liked to call it the Wuhan virus. Therefore, it could not be China's fault. So we know for a fact that they've lied all over the place about this. That is just indisputable. They being the Chinese government. Now,
go ahead.
Yeah, the last thing I was going to say is the Trump State Department, in the person of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who you were just talking about, actually came out and said that this latest, which is that a number of researchers at the Wuhan facility got sick, sick enough to be hospitalized with COVID-like symptoms in November. That was a report over the weekend in the Wall Street Journal, but it's something that the State Department had basically said months ago when Mike Pompeo was still the Secretary of State. So this is something that we should have been able to see were not so many people not sort of blinded by their views on Trump.
Now, Byron, I think there is a second cover-up underway. The first cover-up is by China as to the origin of the virus, and the second cover-up is of legacy media's malpractice on the story. And that includes not just what they didn't cover. And that's what we're seeing a lot of. Oh, we missed this story. You know, we didn't know. We're sorry. And now let's get into it. But they actively purged and tried to destroy the credibility of those who brought these issues forward, to the damage of not even learning about things like gain of function research, which I first discovered when I read Josh Rogan's book, Chaos Under Heaven, where he discusses in some detail gain-of-function research and its dangers. I think I'd seen something about it, but Josh really explains it. They want to cover up for the reason you just cited, they want to cover up how badly they did on this because it tends to prove they were in the tank for Biden and the Democrats all year last year.
Yes, it also just shows they were reflexively anti-Trump. I mean, I think that's the more accurate way to say it. Just reflexively anti-Trump. Also, Dr. Fauci, who emerged as a hero in this story, made clear that he didn't think the lab leak hypothesis was possible and that the evidence all supported some sort of transmission from the wet market, from animal to human transmission. So, and now Dr. Fauci is saying, well, I don't know. It might be anything. I don't have any confidence in any particular theory. So Dr. Fauci has changed his position on this.
But yeah, follow the science did not mean follow the science back then. Follow the science meant follow the narrative.
Exactly. The point is not that we know definitively what happened. The point is, this was just one of many efforts to suppress information in the Trump era in which people who held unpopular opinions were actually suppressed by social media. Obviously, look what happened to the Hunter Biden laptop story. And we're still getting news stories, by the way, out of the Hunter Biden laptop. Remember the
yep.
Recently we had a story about Louis Free, the former FBI director, donating $100,000 to a Biden family fund. That came from the laptop. But there was this clear effort to suppress that. And then later we saw this effort to suppress a clearly based piece about the lab leak theory. It's also
If I ever get around to writing a book on the media, I'll just call it Collapse, because it's collapsed its credibility. But, Byron, I want to tie this all into your Daily Memo newsletter of yesterday on the January 6th commission. I talked about it with Karl Rove yesterday. We played the Marco Rubio Facebook tape in which he says, you know, one of the reasons I don't want the commission is the way the media will handle it. So now the media bias has become so extraordinary that elected officials have to account for how it will tug the lie of the green. That, you know, you just can't expect fair coverage, which is itself warping the coverage even more. It's actually a very dramatically bad cycle for the politics of the United States.
Yeah, I think that on the other side, on the Democratic side, they're also counting on a certain type of media coverage, very positive for them, to use this into 2022 if there were a commission. I mean, the biggest reason that a lot of Republicans, and this most prominently Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy, oppose this commission is that there already are multiple investigations going on. On the criminal front, there is this sprawling, vast Justice Department investigation. More than 450 people charged so far. That number expected to go over 500. An investigation of what the rioters themselves did is being conducted by the Justice Department. Then you have the other angle is what sort of preparations existed? Were they adequate? Obviously, they're not adequate. But what Capitol Police did, what the security agencies did, what kind of warnings there were. There's an investigation going on into that in the Senate House Government Affairs Committee, Government Affairs Committee and the Rules Committee, which oversees the Capitol Police. There's a joint bipartisan investigation going on there right now. You don't hear a lot about it, but they're going to come out with a preliminary report in a couple of weeks. And then finally, there is the issue of accusations that former President Trump incited the riot. And there's been an impeachment on that. I mean, the House produced this big report, sent it to the Senate, Senate Michael's impeachment. There was a trial. I mean, this has been investigated and adjudicated. So that's three right there, which is the reason that Mitch McConnell would cite and that Kevin McCarthy would cite, saying that there does not need to be an additional investigation here.
Rove is not of the belief it will happen. What's your bottom line, Byron, with about 30 seconds left? Do you think it'll happen?
I think it's, I think it's still possible. You had 35 members of the House vote for it, haven't had a vote in the Senate, but there are clearly some. Susan Collins was on television on Sunday saying she believes it was still possible to fix some of the sticking points for the commission. So I'm not actually dead. I think it could still happen.
When Senator Burke came out against it, I kind of put it down on the floor. But we will see. Byron York keeps his ear to the floor, too. Listen, America, come right back. Thank you, Byron. Follow him at Byron York on Twitter. Follow me to the next segment on today's Hugh Hewitt Show.
The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls, for the times they are a-changing.
Welcome back, America. On the day after Bob Dylan's 80th birthday, I welcome Admiral James Stavridis, United States Navy, retired, back to the program. I don't know if he's a Dylan fan or not. It's hard not to be if you're our age. Yeah. Good to see you, Admiral.
Yeah. The thing to really like about Bob Dylan is a Nobel Prize in Literature. How's that for a poet-songwriter? You got to give him his chops.
The only one in the United States history. Let me ask you, Admiral, you, since I last spoke with you, you became the chairman of the Rockefeller Foundation. Congratulations on that significant honor. That's going to be kind of a bandwidth eater, isn't it?
Well, I will have an office up in New York at the headquarters. I will spend a lot of time on our projects around the world. But again, I'm not the president. That's the hands-on CEO, wonderful guy named Rod Shaw, who was director of USAID when I was the NATO commander. So we've worked together extensively. I'll be the overarching authority. I'm the 14th chairman, and I'm very excited to continue to serve this great organization.
Well, congratulations. They made a great choice. Now I want to turn to Belarus. I know about piracy because of reading novels and reading Sea Power by James Stavridis. You know about piracy because as head of NATO, you probably had to deal with pirates at various places. What do you make of what Belarus did to the dissident?
Well, just on NATO and piracy for a second, because it's worth mentioning, all of those missions off the east coast of Africa. The one that Captain Phillips, for example, was involved in, that was a U.S. response. It could as easily have been a NATO response. We always had half a dozen destroyers, cruisers, frigates out there, had air cover. So, yeah, I've spent a lot of time on pirates. Belarus, I'd call this state-sponsored terrorism, state-sponsored piracy. You can put a number of different labels on it, but it's extremely outrageous, and it is a complete violation of international law, and we ought to sanction the hell out of them.
And now, the EU did that yesterday, but have you been to Belarus? I know you've been everywhere, but I don't know if you've been to Belarus. Have you been to Belarus?
One time, and as the saying goes, first prize, two trips to Belarus. Second prize, one trip. It is not a place you want to spend a lot of time. It is the last vestige of the Soviet Union. And Lukashenko, the dictator who I have not met, is someone who is without question the last dictator standing in Europe.
And he is widely, his security service is still known as the KGB, which I learned this weekend. But the idea of forcing down a civilian airline, it's up there with the shoot it down of the KLA 007 or whatever that number was of the doomed aircraft over South Korea. What else is there in the bag of sanctions? I think there are financial portals that can be closed to them. What else do you know of that we could deploy?
Yeah, well, we ought to start with the world of aviation. We ought to simply shut down them from the world's air routes. That's quite easy to do, actually. You tell all the air traffic controllers around Belarus not to respond, not to fly any jets through the region. Secondly, you take they have a national airline, predictably, that ought to be, and I believe will be, completely banned from flying anywhere in the civilized world. Then you get into financial sanctions. And here, beyond the obvious, which is you can't do business with a Belarusian company, the way to go here is secondary sanctions, which is to say you can't do business with a business that is doing business with a Belarusian, which would put immediate, complete halt to any kind of international activity. Then you could ban them from the international financial system, the SWIFT system. There's a whole series of things to be done here. But on this one, you know me, I'm pretty moderate. Hey, let's take our time. Let's figure it out. This is in the category of this cannot stand. Once you surrender to this, then any tin pot dictator gets to just start pulling aircraft down out of the skies. That is no way to run a railroad, let alone an international air system.
It's the SWIFT system that I have in mind, because I do believe that we never have used that against even North Korea, right? But we came close to a couple of times. It's our ultimate hammer. Here's the question. It's a difficult one. I raised it earlier. People might be reluctant to go there because the difference between what Belarus did and Iran has done is actually only in the degree of transparency. Is that significant enough to distinguish state-sponsored terror from Iran versus state-sponsored terror from Belarus?
I think the distinction to be made here is that the Belarusian act is a dagger pointed at the entire global system of trade and transportation. And that is an enormous, vast act, even though it's only a single point. What the Iranians are doing are a series of hundreds, thousands of smaller acts. So it's more difficult to drop a hammer on Iran for any individual given relatively smaller act, more regionally confined. I think this one just has enormous international repercussion, and therefore it merits the full Monty, so to speak.
Now, I want to switch over to naval matter. Last week, the Queen Elizabeth joined up with the Prince of Wales, and two British aircraft carriers with F-35s are now transiting the Med, headed towards the Indian Ocean, headed to the South China Sea. How significant is that? Do we count them in our carrier group now? I mean, they're American planes, and they're being sailed in concert with American navies. What do you think? Are they in our carrier group?
Well, I wouldn't say that to the Brits. They very much believe this is their carrier strike group, of course. But I think they are such good allies and have been with us everywhere, like the Australians, for example, that you can very confidently say, okay, we can count that as we think about where we might end up in a combat situation. And these are two 65,000-ton aircraft carriers. The Brits operate the F-35 as well, although they'll be, as you say, an American squadron alongside a Marine squadron, I believe. And then they also have very capable surface combatants, frigates, destroyers, cruisers, and they just let a contract for three big resupply ships. And that's not sexy, but it's important. If you want to operate a carrier strike group out at sea, you got to have the fuel. So you need that big auxiliary ship. So, yes, these are full-blown carrier strike groups. After an American one, this is the toughest thing at sea. And it makes my heart glad as a old grizzled admiral to see it. But I think it makes hearts beat faster in Honolulu at Indo-Pacific Command more than anywhere else. By the way, new commander out there, Admiral, he just took over from Phil Davidson. Call sign Lung, a good friend.
Lung? And Lung?
Yeah, that's an interesting call sign.
So, Admiral, you have behind you 2034. I had dinner last night with my book-loving friend Glenn in the restaurant business, and often we'll find authors like you to take to dinner at one of his restaurants. And 2034, he liked it a lot. He had only one issue, not issue. He was curious about your naming of the aircraft carriers. Now, we don't want to give away those names, the new aircraft carriers in 2034. How long did you debate those names for the new carriers?
Not a big debate. And that's just part of the fun of being a novelist, right? You get to splash some paint around the canvas. I'm waiting for Hugh Hewitt's first novel and see what you do with some of those political nicknames and where you think political parties are going. By the way, here's the big news. I'll break news on your show. Myself and Elliot Ackerman just in the last couple of days signed a 2-book sequel deal. So we're going to do 2054 and 2074, taking some of the characters and the storylines deep into the 21st century. So look for those.
Oh, my. Congratulations. That means they love the first book, and it continues to sell. 2034. Oh, Glenn loved it. He's a great, great consumer of fiction. He has a great palette for fiction. Now, let me turn to the last subject of the day, which is the war that has just concluded in the Middle East. And I did not have you on during the Hamas's attack on Israel. Does that in any way, in your view, fundamentally change the balance of power in the Middle East?
No, I think it the only impact it will have is a temporary cooling of the Abraham Accords between Israel and some of the Arab states. But that was, I think, a momentary brief blip. And the big muscle movement, as you and I have discussed, is the growing alignment between Israel and the Gulf Arab states, already quite aligned with Jordan and Egypt. That's the big casino in the Middle East, comes out of the Abraham Accord.
Oh, we lost some bandwidth there, Admiral. You're back. So that endures. I think that endures, and the Abraham Accords will flourish. Secretary Blinken is in Israel this morning. This is the 7th Secretary of State that Bibi Netanyahu has received in Israel. I'm curious what you think of the advantages of a democratically elected, and there's no doubt about it, it's a democracy, a democratically elected leader having in the background 7 different experiences with secretaries. I don't think he can be surprised by anything.
No, I think that's right. The only person you can start to compare him to is Queen Elizabeth II, who has been through innumerable prime ministers. Imagine someone who worked with Winston Churchill as a young woman, works with Margaret Thatcher in middle age, and is today working with the David Camerons all the way to the Boris Johnsons of the modern era. It just gives you amazing perspective. Here's a book recommendation, and that's Winston Churchill's book about his contemporaries. It is a remarkable book that kind of puts these portraits. And again, that longevity, which Winston Churchill enjoyed, also contributed to his activity as a statesman. I'm not sure Bibi is doing everything as well as Winston Churchill or as well as Queen Elizabeth. But you're right. That experience helps him, I'm sure.
One of my favorites, The Great Contemporaries, is the name of the book. And one of my favorite portraits in it is Lord Rosebery, a little-known British prime minister from the 19th century, about whom Churchill wrote, "He would not stoop, he did not conquer." And I always think that there's a little bit of that in, you know, the aristocratic deficit is that if they don't get out there and shake the hands, they're not going to actually win the elections, and Lord Rosebery didn't. Admiral Stavridis, congratulations on the Rockefeller Foundation and on the new deal with Elliot. You have no time. I hope you keep doing the radio show. I don't think you have any time.
I will be here every week. Thanks.
Thank you, Admiral. Be well. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172.
Tambourine man, play a song for me.
I'm not sleepy.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Bob Dylan's been doing what he's been doing for 80 years and a day. Happy belated birthday, Bob Dylan. Joined now by United States Senator Tom Cotton from the state of Arkansas. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Hugh. Good to be on with you.
Well, I have been spending some time this morning talking about the fact that 15 months ago, maybe 16 months ago, you were warning that the COVID virus could have originated in a CCP-controlled lab inside of Wuhan. And not only were you dismissed, you were ridiculed. And the accounts of this story that are now coming up have as a primary focus the story, but as a secondary focus, why did the media fail? I'd like you to talk about both of them.
Well, Hugh, what I was saying early last year is just what any Arkansan with common sense would say. Isn't it a shocking coincidence that a novel coronavirus emerged not in some remote village next to a colony of bats living in a nearby cave, but in downtown Wuhan, a city larger than New York, with two labs known to research coronaviruses? I mean, what a shocking coincidence. And since then, the evidence has all piled up in the direction of those laboratories. As I wrote in the Wall Street Journal last April, it obviously didn't come from the food market. That was a cover-up from the very beginning. We knew that they were researching coronaviruses. Our diplomats had gone there in 2018 and reported on shockingly lax safety practices. And even since this controversy last spring, we've had more evidence. You know, look, I presume the Chinese officials have been trying to find the original animal, the original host species from which this originated. It only took them 4 months to find SARS. It only took 9 months to find MERS. No one has been able to point to any host species out in the wild from which this coronavirus would have originated. We've also learned that the shoddy safety practices at those labs was worse than we believed. You know, it is a safety level 4 lab, the most intense kind of safety practices, but they were doing this research under level 2 protocols. I mean, Hugh, that's basically what you see when you go to the dentist, you know, a white lab coat and a face shield. And then also, it's just, again, common sense. We now know that this virus spreads almost exclusively indoors, not outdoors. Isn't it strange that a virus that spreads only indoors is claimed by the Chinese to have originated outdoors in animals? So it's time for the Chinese Communist Party to come clean and give full access to those labs and their personnel in Wuhan. As for the media bias, which was obvious and silly at the time, now it's being exposed because this evidence is piling up, and you have respected science reporters like Nicholas Wade, formerly of the New York Times, who is pointing out just how shoddy the media's reporting was on this last year. I think there's no question they did that in part because I was the first to raise it. And let's just be fair, a lot of people in the blue media don't care for my politics. They also didn't want to feed into anything that the Trump administration said about China's responsibility here. And of course, you have a bunch of liberals and activists in white lab coats, who I won't even call public health experts, who sometimes seem to care more about protecting the reputations of their fellow activists in white lab coats and their fellow scientists around the world than they care about getting to the truth.
Now, Senator Cotton, there is a second cover-up underway. The Chinese Communist Party has a cover-up of the origins of the virus in coordination with the WHO. But the cover-up by the media for the media is what alarms me this morning. I read Glenn Kessler, my colleague at the Washington Post, account, allegedly an account of the chronology of the Wuhan story. And it references that you were first to the bell by a lot. But it does not reference the blowback. It just does not in any way detail the number and force with which that story was suppressed, not unlike the Hunter Biden story. That is a cover-up, and it's a cover-up that serves the continuing credibility of a media that is leaking it away in real time. Do you expect that will change? For example, will the Sunday shows invite you? I mean, you're the guy who went to the bell first. Will they invite you to come and discuss what happened?
Hugh, something tells me probably not, because, as you say, the media is covering for itself, as they always do when they make blatant partisan mistakes. It's not unlike these activists and liberals in white lab coats covering for each other. You know, Dr. Anthony Fauci continues to play word games about NIH funding for this research in the Wuhan laboratories. It's in part because he doesn't want to imperil the relationships that United States scientists have built with scientists around the world. Likewise with the media. They'll cover up the mistakes that they made just on a general reporting level, but they want to put down the memory hole, to use Orwell's phrase, their own partisan attacks, their own baseless slanders against people like me and others who said what was just common sense. This virus emerged a few blocks from labs that is researching exactly these kind of viruses. Maybe we should at least ask the questions about what happened there.
And the our conversation on February 18th of last year, we talked about the number of places you've been ridiculed. And I'm being very self-serving. If there was a Pulitzer awarded for continuous aggressive warning reporting that was eventually proven true about this virus, I would win it, and Byron York would come in second. But the media did not want to hear it. I mean, they just did not want to hear it. I think it had more to do with you than it did the theory, because the theory was always eminently reasonable. Not dispositive, right? You can't have dispositive proof about that which you cannot test. But that they locked us out of the lab was, to me, one of those dogs that barked that you have to just look at.
Yeah, Hugh, that's right. I mean, the media was attacking me from the very beginning, not because they disagreed with the questions I was asking, not because they thought there was conclusive proof that the virus originated in some food market in downtown Wuhan, but because they don't like my politics, because the media is overwhelmingly liberal, just like the Democratic politicians and the Democratic activists with whom they all went to college and sat in campus seminar rooms talking about social justice. And as long as someone like me was the one who was asking these very reasonable questions, they were going into overdrive to attack me. Look, I don't care if the media attacks me. They can do that all day long. I'll punch back twice as hard, especially when the lives and the livelihoods of millions of Americans are at stake, as they were last February when we were trying to figure out exactly where this virus originated and therefore hopefully get some insight in how to stop it. Now it's a matter of finding out so there can be accountability. Just think, if it's conclusively established, Hugh, that the Chinese Communist Party was responsible through its negligence in these labs and then its malevolence in the cover-up for unleashing a once-in-a-century pandemic on the world.
Now, Dr. Collins and Dr. Fauci on this show have said the United States did not fund gain-of-function research. The reason I bring this up is during the debates in the fall campaign, then-candidate, now President Biden, said what he would do is force China to allow American scientists in, and he would force them. I remember this so clearly, because there was no follow-up, of course. How are you going to do that, Vice President Biden? Do you think he's done anything even to force the clarity that we need on gain-of-function research? And I know they both denied it. I would just like to see them ask. I think Dr. Fauci's on the Hill today to define gain-of-function. And I mean, you know how to do this. You're a lawyer. You can't just let people under oath just say, no, we didn't do that.
Yeah, Hugh, the Biden administration has not done anything, to my knowledge, to hold China accountable for this. But look, I just have to say this about Francis Collins and Tony Fauci. They are playing word games to deny what happened and to avoid accountability for what could be a huge scandal. Let me just lay out the facts for your audience. There is no question, it's a matter of public record, that Dr. Fauci's agency inside the National Institutes of Health gave hundreds of thousands of dollars in grant money to an American organization, which then turned around and funneled that money to these labs in Wuhan. Second, there is no doubt, it's in the public record, the so-called bat lady in these labs who researched bat coronaviruses even thanked Dr. Fauci's agency publicly on the record for the research they were doing into coronaviruses to make them more contagious and therefore more dangerous. What could be a gain function other than making a virus more contagious? But here's the real kicker, Hugh. The Obama White House prohibited grants for that kind of research in 2014. This money did not begin to flow until after 2014. So there is a real question whether Francis Collins and Tony Fauci explicitly disregarded the direction of the Obama White House and gave hundreds of thousands of taxpayer dollars to Chinese scientists to conduct deadly, dangerous research. Tony Fauci needs to answer those questions and not simply continue to deny it and play word games with the American people. He better give answers in 2 hours when he's on Capitol Hill.
He has denied it on this show and other places, but it'll be under oath today. And Dr. Fauci has changed a bit in his answers on this. So I will be watching to see, again, if they change. And Josh Rogan has told me how they have changed. Let me close by asking you this, Senator Cotton, in terms of going forward, we will never get any knowledge out of China about what happened here. They will not allow us. Is there any reason for us to stay in the WHO, given their collaboration in cover-up one?
No, Hugh. We made the right decision last year to leave the World Health Organization. The Biden administration made a politically correct decision to re-enter the World Health Organization, which to this day is still covering up for Chinese communists. They sent a team of so-called experts to Wuhan that involved like food safety experts that are testing the temperature of donuts in Europe to investigate this. They didn't even get to speak to the people involved in the research. They certainly didn't get to review any records. They, in effect, sat in a conference room in these laboratories, got a PowerPoint briefing from Chinese communist apparatchiks, and then said, all clear, nothing to see here. So we should not be a part of the World Health Organization's whitewash of what happened in China. We should lead the free world in getting to the bottom of what happened and making sure that Chinese communists can never poison mankind again.
So my switch of subjects very quickly. You are going to begin hearings on judicial nominees for circuit courts. And the Dobbs case is now before the Supreme Court that puts into question Roe and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. How will you explore the stare decisis aspects of Dobbs with these nominees? Do you intend to do so, and ought they to answer those questions? Because they're not Ruth Bader Ginsburg. They're not the Ginsburg rule question. Questions about stare decisis, which we've watched for years and years, Democrats ask of Republican nominees.
Well, Hugh, it's a little difficult to explore the Supreme Court's abortion case law in these hearings because the abortion case law is all over the map. As Justice Scalia once said, the Supreme Court has basically created its own entire area of jurisprudence when it comes to abortion geared towards one thing, to make sure that there are millions of babies who are aborted in this country. That's why I welcome the Supreme Court's decision to hear the Dobbs case, and I hope that they will bring clarity to this area of law, and I hope that they will lay down a clear marker that we protect unborn life in this country.
Senator Tom Cotton, thank you as always. If you want to join in that effort, by the way, now is the moment. Today, you can stand for freedom with the Alliance Defending Freedom by going to adflegal.org/you. They are a sponsor of this show. I love these guys. They do great legal work, and they are briefing Dobbs. That's adflegal.org/you, or you can call 866-359-9644 for more information, 866-359-9644. Let me also remind you, I just put some relieffactor.com in my it's a two-day trip, so it's a backpack trip. Yeah, you put on a suit, you bring a couple of shirts and your doc kit, and you're on the plane. And I don't believe in waiting around in a lot of lobbies. So I zipped through, but I went up and put my relieffactor.com into my backpack so I'd have it tomorrow morning in Nashville and Thursday morning in Nashville when I'm broadcasting from the RGA, because I don't want to walk around Nashville and not have relieffactor.com working on my behalf. 1995, America, get you started. If you're new to the Hugh Hewitt Show, it's your first day you've listened, get used to it. Three times a day, 5 days a week. I tell you, relieffactor.com works for me. I take it every morning the first hour, and I remind you before you leave for work. You're later if you're a West Coast American. I'm getting ready to go to work at 5:45. Get your relieffactor.com before you leave the house and come right back for Senator Marsha Blackburn. I'm going to her state. We'll talk about that next on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
There must be some way out of here, said the Joker to the thief.
Welcome back, America. Bob Dylan turned 80 yesterday. Hope he had a great birthday. I'm joined by Senator Marsha Blackburn of the great state of Tennessee, to which I'm flying in a couple hours. Good morning, Senator. How are you?
I am doing great, and I'm delighted to know you're going to Tennessee.
Now, the RGA is down in Nashville. I got to go talk to the governors about what they're going to do, but I want to talk to you about the Dobbs case. You're on Judiciary, Senator. Dobbs puts into play Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. Are you an optimist about this?
pardon me. We are always going to be optimistic, hopefully optimistic. But what we are certainly doing is realizing that that will be a steep mountain to climb.
Now, you have judicial nominees coming before the committee all the time. Do you ask them, do you press them on stare decisis and whether or not, the way that Democrats pressed Justices Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett?
I generally go after their complete approach to the rule of law. I think that tells you a lot about where they're going to come down on issues. I look for judges who are going to be constitutionalists. I do not want to see judges that are going to be political activists. And that is my approach as they come to me.
All right, let me turn to your letter to Merrick Garland yesterday. I like what the letter says, which is, why are you restoring funding to sanctuary cities? But do you really expect him to respond, much less to act?
We do expect them to do something. Absolutely. And people are, they're ready for some things to be done. So I have to tell you this. When you look at the environment, there is a tremendous amount of buyer's remorse that is out there. People that supported Joe Biden because they thought he was going to be a moderate. And what they have seen is something that is going to be, they've got Bernie Sanders as president. So sending the letter is a way to say, look, we are watching and the people are watching, and thereby we're coming to you for greater clarification.
Now, Senator Blackburn, there are two stories this morning on the American Information Resilience Act, which is the $250 billion in funding that might go towards strengthening our defenses and semiconductor production against China, and the infrastructure bill. Do you think either or both of those are going to pass the Senate?
It's going to be very difficult to get Joe Biden's version of an infrastructure bill through the body. Now, when it comes to returning manufacturing from China, even before COVID, I had a bill with Senator Menendez that would return the manufacturing of our active pharmaceutical ingredients to the U.S. And this is the Sam C. bill, Securing America's Medicine Cabinet bill. And, Hugh, the thing is, we need to bring this critical infrastructure manufacturing back. But you don't need to say, okay, we're going to bring back microprocessors, and all the money is going to go into microprocessors or semiconductor chips, and not look holistically, because you do have pharmaceuticals, you have rare earth minerals. There needs to be a better approach to this. And instead of just saying government is going to do it, why don't we look at how government incentivizes the private sector to do this?
Last question, Senator. Have you made up your mind on a January 6th commission and whether or not you'll be voting for it or seeking to amend the bill that came over from the House or just opposing it?
I'm going to oppose it because what we know is that there are two investigations in the Senate that are nearly complete that are going to bring forward a tremendous amount of information. And when you have the Intel Committee with their report and the Rules Committee with their report, these are yet to come out. We also have law enforcement that is conducting their investigation. People have been arrested. There are some trials that are going to take place. There's information that is going to come from there. Now, if you put a commission over much of that, you end up unintentionally many times freezing the work that law enforcement is doing. So I think we are better served to not do a January 6th commission and let the regular order review and investigations take place, those reports be rendered, and then let law enforcement have their ability to work, and then let's see if there are still unanswered questions. I think what the Democrats are trying to do is to keep this as a headline story because they feel like it's the only shot they have at keeping the House or the Senate majority in 2022.
Senator Blackburn, thank you as always. Off to your home state of Tennessee. Now, don't, however, America, miss me tomorrow when I'm in Nashville talking to the governors of America who are down there gathered at the Republican Governors Association. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Harley. And thank you, Generalissimo, who's on a plane himself. I'll talk to you from Nashville tomorrow on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.